Orson Welles speaking. I've got a spy story for you today, a word from Washington, and some true confessions about the Martian broadcast. I'll get to that in just a minute.
Literally, millions of people are waiting to buy a new radio for their homes, waiting to see what the sets to come are going to be like. Of course, everyone knows that some of these sets will be put together by companies who have never made radios before, but who want to cash in on the big demand. Others will be made by old-timers, able to pick up manufacture where they left off in 1942. But as far as we know, no other manufacturer shares the unique position of Lear. Lear has built radios since 1930, the most exacting radios, radios for aircraft. To be acceptable, they had to be the finest radios that could be made, and Lear has become known as the name men fly by. So Lear's experience has been at the top level of radio design and manufacture. Now, Lear is putting Lear foresight and know-how into home radios. Just for example, one of the new things you'll find in Lear radios is the Lear wire that remembers, a method of recording on wire that's built right into the set. Snap a switch and you make a lifelike record of your children's songs, your own talents, or even a radio program taken right off the air. This record can be a few minutes or more than an hour long. It can be replayed for a lifetime. Yet whatever you don't want to keep can be erased by merely recording something else right over it. There's never been anything like this in home radios before. So before you settle on any radio for your home, be sure to see the one with the nameplate Lear, L-E-A-R. Now, Mr. Welles brings you his views and opinions on events as he sees them. The opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of Lear Incorporated.
Exclusive from Washington. The State and War Departments have just declined to absorb the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. I guess they figure all those spies are too tough to handle. A high source in Washington told me this morning that an executive order will shortly set up the Cloak and Dagger outfit as a new independent agency. Here's a story we couldn't tell until now. It's a swell plot for the movies, but you can take it the way I'm giving it to you. Neat. It's perfectly true. Soon after we ended the war, an OSS agent infiltrated into Nazi-controlled France. To keep his, the most secret of all missions, he was in contact with only one OSS man in the United States. If he was captured, tortured, he'd then be able to reveal nothing about OSS save the name of his one Washington contact. For a year, he sent out invaluable information, receiving periodic instructions from his Washington contact, but suddenly, he received no more secret orders, no more curt receipts. After a time, concluding his mission was over, he slipped out of France at some peril, made his way back to Washington, reported to OSS, but in the wondrous ways of bureaucracy, his one contact had been fired months before. And when the agent from France claimed to be an OSS man, no one knew him or anything about him. He was promptly clapped into jail and suspected of being a Nazi agent. Not until many weeks elapsed was he able to escape shooting as a Nazi spy by tracing down his one-time contact to prove he was really one of the most valuable of our Cloak and Dagger boys. Well, Russia takes her place this week at the Far Eastern Advisory Commission meetings in the nation's capital. According to unimpeachable State Department sources, it was the Russians who initiated the new discussions which have led to her joining the Japanese talks. I don't think we need any better proof that Joe Stalin wants to get along with us. Word seeping back to the White House has finally begun to penetrate the closed doors and is finally reaching the ears of the tired, worried occupant of that hardback swivel chair, that famous chair in the chief executive's oval study. Inside the now gleaming, freshly painted presidential offices, there's a cold awareness of the fact that if the United States wants war with Russia, it will make that war all by itself. Russia deposits her formal entry into the United Nations with the State Department. At that same moment, the world organization springs to life, the seed carefully nurtured under an older and greater president, planted and tenderly, fairly tenderly cared for on California's jutting San Francisco shale, becomes the world's first faint hope of future peace. The corridors of the State Department and of London's Foreign Office in Whitehall have been buzzing with reports that Russia would bolt the new organization before it was set up. But Russia proves now that she's willing to meet us halfway toward world peace in an organization inside of which she is certain to be badly outvoted. More good news, bad news for the vicious poll tax. Leaders of the anti-poll tax fight are now pretty sure that they're in a position to put the heat on the White House, and they think they can force the administration leaders in the Senate to ram the bill through. Harry Truman, who you know has boasted of how well he gets along with the Southern senators, is waking up to the fact that it's high time he won the support of the Negro voters of America. Just now, I think his stock with Negro voters isn't worth a penny a share. You can bet the poll tax voters will put the issue squarely up to the president. Be a real test of where he stands. Jennings Perry, publisher of the Nashville Tennessean and head of the National Committee to Combat the Poll Tax, said this week that he saw a great contradiction between America's formal intervention abroad to guarantee a free vote when our own country is a classic example of voteless autocracy in many regions. Perry asks what the reaction would be if Bulgaria sent a delegation to the voteless nation's capital and the poll tax-paying South to investigate the absence of free elections in the United States. And speaking of elections, two vital ones affecting the ultimate political destiny of our nation take place day after tomorrow, one in New York, the other in Detroit. Should Manhattan's progressive candidate General O'Dwyer win by the expected overwhelming margin, substantial hustling to the left and a new love for liberalism will be very evident around the White House. Should the progressive candidate in Detroit come through as well, the political forces which won the last presidential election may be able to press those issues on which their candidates, including Mr. Truman, campaigned. Well, we turn now to the fabulous city of Rio. Beautiful Rio, Rio by the Sea. The news from there this week is that Mr. Getulio Vargas lost his job. It was a big job being president of one of the world's biggest countries. And through the years, my friend Mr. Vargas turned it into a much bigger job by throwing away all the ballot boxes in Brazil and going into business for himself. Goodwill ambassadors, like your obedient servant, were cautioned at the American embassy and elsewhere, not to mention the unpleasant word, but the fact is that Getulio was a dictator. I give him his first name, Getulio, not to parade the intimate terms of our friendship, which I'm not particularly proud, but simply because that's the way he's referred to by some 43 million Brasileiros, very few of whom knew the big boss at all. Getulio was always. He's a clever one, this Getulio of ours, the minute you got off the plane. He doesn't say much, your Brazilian friends will tell you, but he doesn't need to. Not that one, not our slick, shrewd little Getulio. He can be silent in 10 languages. Not only that, they told you he could take off his socks without taking off his shoes. Living in Brazil and in different parts of it, as I did, you got the impression that this dictatorship was being sold to the suckers by charm rather than by demagoguery. And if you got to know Getulio, as I did pretty well, this idea was strengthened. From across the room, the man you met looked like a retired candy manufacturer, a happy, chubby little granddaddy whose declining years were given over to charitable works. His defenders would tell you that this wasn't far from the truth, that under the sunny despotism of the Década Getuliana, industrial production was increased by 1.485%, that the external debt was reduced, national parks built, highways and airports instituted. You were shown pictures of all these lovely things happening under the benevolent eye of Getulio, and then you got right up close to that eye, the real thing, not a photograph, and caught the glitter, the wily, witty, wicked glitter, the eye of an old crow, as old as sin, nesting on the Sphinx. He always had a joke for me. He knew more gossip than you'd think a dictator could have time for, and he loved mentioning by name my latest date. I was a bachelor in Brazil, to prove he knew everything I was up to. And he did. And speaking of pictures of his good deeds, I remember the night we tried to photograph one of the tenement districts in the favelas, that's the hills above Rio, Thugs surrounded us, and after a siege of beer bottles, empties, of course, stones, bricks, and I hate to think what else, we retreated to a more photogenic district, clutching our Technicolor cameras as we went. And if you knew the size of the darn things, you'd grant that's no mean trick. Well, Getulio's partisans used to remind you that he unified the country, but everywhere in the street cafes, the clubs, the universities, I heard Brazilian people grumbling back at this sotto voce. Oh, yes, they said. Of course, there's no unity so perfect as the unity of slaves. Of slaves in a barracoon. The first year or two of the war, that grumbling was still dissipated in those charming jokes. A Brazilian specialty, those jokes. Deflating the object of ridicule, but also lowering the pressure of political discontent. The one about Vargas's picture, for example, that joke. There was a law, up to last week in Brazil, that every place of business must carry on its walls prominently framed the likeness of Getulio. According to the story, Mussolini checks in at the pearly gates of heaven, shows his identification, is tossed out for his presumption by the proper cherubim and seraphim. Then Hitler appears, same thing happens to him. Finally, Vargas presents himself before St. Peter, who goes to the Almighty and says, "You've got to let in Getulio. You've got his picture on your wall." About those jokes, we like to think that satire is a dangerous political weapon in representative government. It is. Under a despotism, it's a safety valve that works the clock around for the despot. Vargas actually hired people to make up those jokes about him. After Brazil ended the war, the people stopped telling jokes. Vargas promised free elections because he had to, promised them for right after VE Day. When he began thinking of declaring war on Japan, Brasileiro said it was a ruse to put off the balloting a little longer. A high-ranking Brazilian government official told me at the Conference of Inter-American States in Mexico last spring that the example of American soldiers voting last fall for a president in all the theaters of war, a spectacle beheld by amazed Brazilian GIs, would cost Vargas his power when those Brazilian GIs return to Brazil. I printed that prediction in my newspaper column, and this week's flash of the bloodless removal of the smiling Iron Man bears it out. I happen to be intimately acquainted with the men behind the coup. They say their purpose is the guarantee of those elections so long delayed, and although the army figures ominously in the picture, I'll tell you that I'm inclined to be very optimistic. There are many real freedoms in Brazil today. Social freedoms, no dictator, however sly, could wipe away. I think these next years will discover a truly democratic Brazil, a valuable friend for our cause in Latin America. My guess is that if we move forward into a free world, Brazil will be marching right along beside us. And that, I think, I hope, winds up the story of the cheerful tyrant from the South. This week retired as plain Mr. Vargas. Moral: the most dangerous dictator is the nicest one. Well, a fine, bounding case of strep throat kept me from calling on you last week, which was closer to Halloween than this is, but we're still close enough, I hope, to that witching season for me to mark an anniversary for the Mercury Theater. It was on Halloween Eve many a weary year ago that we brought before the listening public the first intelligence of a certain interplanetary invasion. Much has happened since then. There were real invasions. One black Sunday morning in December, I was sitting in the newsroom of a radio station when the word came to us about Pearl Harbor. I remember that for a little while, a lot of people thought I was up to my old tricks. I only wish I had been. Well, to be less gloomy, by way of goodbye today, may I please tell you an anecdote or two about the men from Mars. But first, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
Up to now, only aviators have had Lear radios. They haven't been made for homes before. But now the engineering, the foresight, the meticulous manufacture that Lear knows so well is going into fine home radios, and what sets they are. Beautifully designed and made with a master craftsman's touch. Some include television. Some have record players and automatic record changers. Some have FM worldwide shortwave and the Lear wire recorder I described before. But if you think that radios with all these fine features must cost a lot, just forget it. For these fine Lear radios are right along in price with sets that don't offer nearly so much. There's a good-looking, capable table model at $19.95. And at the other end of the line, there's a beautiful console combination with television, FM, recorder, and everything that sells for about $500. We'll let you know just when you can hear these radios at your Lear dealer studios. Then you can see for yourself how really fine they are. We know you're going to agree that you get the most value for your investment when you buy a radio that carries the name Lear. L-E-A-R. And now a final word from Orson Welles.
Well, that notorious Martian broadcast hit a large number of people in a large number of ways. There was, among other things, a strong revival of religious sentiment, I understand, and the churches were well filled for the whole of that hectic night. My beloved friend Jack Barrymore was taken in by his own account, and when we flashed the word that the men from Mars had taken Princeton and were on their way up Fifth Avenue, Jack went to the kennels at the back of his house, opened the doors, and told a group of bewildered St. Bernard dogs that they had their freedom. And Bing Crosby tells a wonderful story about a famous golfer whose name I'd better withhold because Bing tells me that he'd looked upon the wine, this golfer had looked upon it when it was red and before he started listening to the show. That afternoon, seems he'd done famously at an important match, some links in New England, and with golfer friends, he was driving back to New York with the radio going on in the car. About the time our radio actor, president, appealed from the White House for the people to keep calm, the notable sportsman gave way to honest tears. "Just think," he said to his colleagues through his racking sobs, "I beat my best score today, and now the world is coming to an end. Nobody will ever know about it." I wish I could tell you more, but it's time to leave you now. Please let me come to call again, and thanks for this time. Till then, speaking for my sponsors, the makers of Lear Radio, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.